Hello, and welcome back to another podcast. Now, this is an Australian case, and it is the case of Anita Cobby. Now, this takes place over the years of 1982 to 1985, I'm pretty sure. Let me get into the story. Sydney. Anita Cobby was a gorgeous woman who easily could have been a model and had dreamed of becoming one at a particular time in her life. During her youth, she participated in several beauty pageants. At age 20, she won the Miss Western Suburbs Beauty Pageant, earning a spot in the Miss Australia pageant. While Cobby had a promising career as a model, the beauty queen decided to follow in her mother's footsteps and become a registered nurse. She met her future husband, John Cobby, at nursing school, and they married on March 27, 1982. The Cobbies settled quickly into married life when John Cobby won $10,000 on a horse race a few years later. The couple decided to travel abroad and visit the United States and Europe. They returned in 1985. Although Cobby wanted to continue travelling, her husband yearned to return to Australia to settle down and start a family. But Cobby was resistant. She already suffered a miscarriage and wanted to continue exploring the world. The dispute caused tension in their marriage, and the couple separated in December 1985. Cobby moved in with her parents, Gary and Grace Lynch, on Surveillance Street in Blacktown. She and her husband remained friends and stayed in contact regularly. As a bit of time passed, they started talking about getting back together. What happened next wrecked the couple's plans forever and outraged an entire nation. On Sunday, February 2nd, 1986, Cobby, 26 years old, awoke at 5 a.m. excuse me, took a train into Sydney and worked a 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. shift at Sydney Hospital. Her husband called to ask if she wanted to see him after her shift ended, but she told him she had plans with friends. Cobby and two fellow nurses, Annette Lynn Bradshaw and Eleni Bray, had dinner and wine at a Redfern restaurant that evening. At 8:30 p.m, Bray, who lived in Crow's Nest, offered Cobby a place to stay for the night, but Cobby declined, saying she wanted to sleep late the following morning. The woman's next shift did not start until 1:30 p.m. the next day. Bradshaw drove Cobby to the Central Railway Station at 8:45 p.m. She boarded the train to Blacktown and arrived at Blacktown Railway Station around 9:45 p.m. Usually Cobby called her father for a ride home, but the payphones were out of order and no cabs were available at the taxi rank. Cobby had no choice but to make the 30-minute walk to her parents' house. She would never make it. As Cobby walked west on Newton Road about 9:50 p.m, a group of five men, including three brothers, pulled up beside her in a H.T. Holden Kingswood car. The men were later identified as Michael, Mick Murphy, Gary Murphy, Leslie Murphy, John Raymond Travers, and Michael James Murdoch. Murdoch and one of the other men excited the vehicle, exited the vehicle, grabbed Cobby and forced her kicking and screaming into the car. Once the men had Cobby in the vehicle, they ordered her to remove her clothes. When she refused, they repeatedly punched her in the face, breaking her nose and cheekbones. They then raped Cobby and forced her to perform oral sex on them in the car. The men drove to a gas station and paid for gas using Cobby's money. Afterward, they took the woman to a cow paddock on Rain Road. Now, Peter Brock Drive. In Prospect, where they dragged her out of the car and through the barbed wire fence, they tossed Cobby on the ground, where all five men savagely raped her and subjected her to 2 hours of inhumane brutality. Concerned that Cobby had seen the men's faces and could identify them, Travers slit her throat, nearly decapitating her. Sorry about that. They left her in the paddock to die and drove off. Reports vary on witnesses to the abduction. A June 11th, 1987 piece in the Sydney Morning Herald states that Linda and John McGorgory, who lived on Newton Street, heard a woman's screams and ran outside, where they observed two men forcing a woman into a vehicle around 9:50 p.m. February 2nd. Their older brother Paul did not witness the abduction. However, he arrived home shortly after and hopped in his car to chase after the vehicle, but lost sight of it. He continued looking for the men, the men's car, eventually spotted an empty Holden near a cow paddock on Rain Road, now Peter Brock Drive. Excuse me. In Prospect, but decided it was not the same vehicle. However, it was the car involved in the abduction. Cobby's kidnappers were hiding with her in the grass, waiting until the man gave up and drove off. When Cobby near arrived home that night, her parents assumed she had stayed overnight in Sydney. At 2 p.m. on Monday, February 3rd, staff member and Sydney Hospital called the Lynch home concerned because Cobby had not shown up for work. Cobby's mother knew this was out of character and reported her daughter missing to the Blacktown police. The following day, a local farmer named John Rean noticed his cattle gathering around an object on the ground in the paddock near Rean Road. He went to investigate and found Cobby's bloody and battered body. He later said that when he looked at the body, he was sure she was begged for death. Rean drove back home and telephoned the police. Rean told investigators that he heard screams on the night of February 2nd, but chalked them up to teenagers partying along Rean Road, somewhat of a lover's lane back then. There were always cars coming and going from there, he said. When the police arrived at the crime scene, they were utterly shocked at the sight of them. The dead woman was naked, lying face down. When they turned her over, her eyes were still opened and her face frozen in sheer terror. She had a severe neck wound, and one detective thought her head would fall off when they lifted her. Police theorized her killers had used an axe or shovel to cut her throat. She also had numerous lacerations on her body, but the true terror of what Cobby suffered would not be revealed until medical examiner completed the autopsy. There were no identification at the crime scene, so detectives had no idea of the victim's name. However, they noticed a unique ring on her finger and figured it might be the only way to identify her. Detective Sergeant Ian Speedy Kennedy knew Cobby had been reported missing. He slipped the ring off the victim's finger, put it in an evidence bag, and took it to the Lynch home to see if the family recognized it. Gary Cobby thought it belonged to his daughter, but was not positive. Cobby's husband was at a residence with his father and a friend when he learned of his wife's disappearance. Devastated, he drove to another Sydney suburb the next day to see if his wife was visiting friends there. While driving, he heard on the radio that a body had been found in Prospect. He stopped at a payphone and called his parents. Kennedy was there. His parents were too distraught to speak, so Kennedy answered the phone. Later that afternoon, John Cobby confirmed that the ring found on the body was his wife's distinctive Russian-style wedding ring. Authorities spent hours searching the paddock and combining the fields around Rain Road, hoping to find the murder weapon, but they found nothing. Cobby's clothes, including her pink and white striped pants, a white top with three buttons, a masculine shoes, and a large black corduroy bag containing her nurse's uniform and purse were missing. Sorry, by the way, if you can hear screaming out there. The murder investigation started as usual. Detectives questioned those closest to the victim, starting with John Cobby. Due to immense grief and pressure from the detectives, he falsely confessed to killing his wife during the interview. Investigators were hesitant about the confusion because they believed the killing to a random act of violence. Medical examiner Dr. Joseph Maloof conducted the autopsy. After viewing the report, investigators believed that more than one person was involved in the horrific murder and ruled out John Cobby as a suspect. On February 6th, the public learned the grim details of Cobby's murder when morning radio host John Laws read a leaked copy of Cobby's autopsy report live on air. Her killing was more gruesome than anyone could have imagined. Maloof later testified that Cobby had been sexually assaulted, anally, orally, and vaginally. He found multiple bruising on her head and body inflicted before death. Some of her head injuries were caused by feet and fists. The men had kicked and punched her numerous times. Cobby had one bruise caused by a blow of considerable force around her right eye. She had abrasions to her back, both legs, breasts, left shoulder and both legs and thighs, plus more minor continuous to both upper arms. Some of these could have streamed from the barbed wire fence, Maloof said. According to one source, both of Cobby's shoulders were broken. Two fingers on Cobby's right hand were smashed from defending herself from the killer's blows. Three other fingers were nearly severed from the axe or knife that had sliced her throat. The young woman had three major and three minor lacerations to her neck, resulting in the right ear severed in three places. Maloof said most of the structures and muscles in the right side of her neck and trachea were also severed. He estimated it took the woman at least 2 minutes to die. Upon learning the woman's horrific ordeal, the public demanded justice for Cobby, who devoted her life to helping others. The pain and suffering she experienced before death must have been excruciating beyond belief. Excuse me. Investigators were determined to get the killers off the streets so a crime like this would not happen again. Detectives reenacted Cobby's movements on the night of her murder. Police Constable Debbie Wallace, who eventually became Detective Superintendent, dressed similarly to what Cobby wore the night and rode the 9:12 p.m. train from Central Railway Station to Blacktown. She was 25 at the time and similar in size to Cobby. Police prohibited reporters from riding the trains, but they could take photographs as Wallace boarded in Sydney and exited it in Blacktown. As Wallace walked the length of the train, detectives interviewed the passengers and showed them Cobby's picture. They had hoped to jog the memories of passengers who regularly rode that specific train. However, they were on the wrong train and later learned that Cobby took the 8:50 p.m. train to Blacktown. The McGregorys gave the police a description of the kidnapper's vehicle, a light-coloured early model Holden Kingswood sedan in poor condition with patchy paintwork. Under hypnosis, one of them recalled the car's license plates. Police traced the plates and discovered the vehicle was stolen. An information tip led them to Murphy Brothers. Investigators discovered the brothers were associates of Murdoch and Travers, arrested them at a relative's home and detained Leslie Murphy in Trubber's residence. The police charged Murdoch with the car theft. He was released on bail while investigators held Trubbers for questioning. Gary Murphy and Michael Murphy went into hiding. With the help of a female witness known as Miss X, the police gained confessions from Murdoch and Trubbers. Miss X knew the men, and she became a crucial figure in the case. Armed with a hidden microphone and a tape recorder, Miss X brought cigarettes to Trubbers in his jail cell and started a conversation about the murder. She later met Kennedy at Greenville Railway Station, and he told her to proceed to Murdoch's home on Booth Street, wearing hidden microphone. Miss X told Murdoch she had spoken to Trubbers and knew of their atrocities against Cobby. Both men confessed to Miss X. Police questioned Murdoch, and he later took investigators to the bus stop on Newton Road, where he said he and the other four men had abducted Cobby. Detective Kennedy asked if he had helped put her into the car, and he answered yes. However, he denied raping her. Investigators then launched a search for the fugitive Murphy brothers. Shortly after questioning Murdoch, they broadcasted photos of the men on television and the front page of the newspapers. A tipster said two men fitting their description were staying in a two-story townhouse at Tarry Way, Glenfield, roughly 33 kilometres south of Blacktown. That tip resulted in the capture of the fugitive Murphy brothers on February 26th, 1986. Detective Kennedy and another detective caught the brothers at the townhouse. Michael Murphy was watching TV while Gary Murphy attempted to escape, but Kennedy tackled him to the ground, searching the man's face. The fugitive wet himself during the capture, and local media took a picture of Gary Murphy in his wet jeans. The Murphy brothers and Trubbers came from large families with multiple siblings. The local police knew the Murphy family well. Gary Murphy and Michael Murphy were unemployed, while Leslie Murphy worked as a maintenance worker. Gary Murphy was hard of hearing and a convicted car theft. Gary Murphy and Michael Murphy met Trubbers while drinking and smoking marijuana at various hotels around Doonside. Trubbers was in and out of children's court growing up and sent to a juvenile detention facility. He had once bragged of having sex with a goat before slitting its throat. Murdoch was unemployed and worshipped Trubbers. Michael Murphy told investigations on the day of Cobby's homicide. He and the other four men had been drinking alcohol at Doonside Hotel from 4 to 8 p.m. They left the hotel and drove to Windsor 24 kilometres north of Blacktown. On their way back from Windsor, they spotted Cobby, grabbed her, and took her to the paddock to rape her. None of the men showed signs of remorse over the killing when they appeared in court on two separate days. A screaming, angry crowd, more than 200 to 300 citizens, gathered at Blacktown Court each time. The scene was intense. Nearby construction workers hung an FI with the noose from the nearby rooftop, and locals held signs calling for the men's executions. The men were charged with abducting, assaulting, murdering, raping, and robbing Cobby. Travers was additionally charged with two counts of assaulting another woman at Toongabby on January 8, 1986. The trial started on March 24, 1987 at Darlinghurst Supreme Court and lasted 12 weeks. Several people testified, including Bradshaw Bray, Maloof, and Cobby's father. Maxine Greensmith, a neighbour of Travers, told the court that she had noticed a funny-smelling fire burning in the men's backyard and saw the five accused standing around the fire, drinking beer and talking loudly. The men later told detectives they had burned Cobby's clothing and nursing bag that night. On June 10, 1987, the jury found all five men guilty and were ultimately sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. John Cobby did not attend the trial. Consumed with grief, he relocated to the US the day after his wife's funeral. However, he did not escape the pain of losing his wife, and he became heavily addicted to drugs. After a minor accident, he decided to sober up. He moved back to Australia in 1987 and changed his last name to Francis to avoid publicity and maintain privacy. He remarried, and he had a second wife and had two children together. The couple eventually divorced. In 2016, he had his son were watching television when a documentary on Cobby's murder came on the screen and he began to cry. Francis decided to tell his children that he was John Cobby, Anita Cobby's husband. After that, he went back to Cobby. He still mourns the loss of his first wife and blames himself for her death. For years, he did not know the full details surrounding her gruesome murder or the names of her killers, but now he knows. A couple of months later, after Cobby's murder, Sydney Hospital unveiled a plaque on the wall of the hospital's chapel in her honour. John Cobby occasionally visits and talks to his deceased wife. The Lynchers created the Anita Cobby Nursing Scholarship to aid nurses in continuing their professional training. In 1993, the Lynchers and the parents of Ebony Simpson, a 9-year-old girl who was raped and murdered in 1992, established the Homicide Victim Support Group in Parramatta. According to the support group website, after the Lynchers and The Simpsons in it for the first time. They recognized the very real need to set up an organization which could offer counseling, support, and information to families and friends of homicide victims throughout New South Wales. The organisation currently has over 4,000 families in the group. Cobby's father died in 2008 at age 90, followed by his wife in 2013 at age 88. Cobby's sister, Catherine Szeleska, and her family held a public memorial in Blacktown on February 2nd, 2015. Several police officers retired. Sheriff Inspector, Gary Raymond, who had worked on Cobby's case, attended the ceremony. Szeleska gave a moving speech about her sister, saying, "She was a great sister, great daughter, very caring, kind and compassionate." According to the website Mamma Mia, Szeleska is the patron of an Inuvit HVSG project called Grace's Plate, a world first residential trauma centre dedicated to children impacted by homicide. The project is named after her mother. A small Blacktown park was named the Anita Cobby Reserve in her honour. It sits on Surveillance Street, where her parents lived, and a few blocks from her abduction site. Miss X received numerous death threats from the public and went into the witness protection program. Michael Murphy died from liver cancer in February 2019. On June 25, 2019, a gang of inmates attacked Gary Murphy, then 61, in the shower block at Sydney's Long Bay Jail. A month later, he was seen in public for the first time, emerging from a secure wing at Sydney's Prince of Wales Hospital, handcuffed and in a wheelchair. Reporters outside the hospital asked if he had any remorse over killing Cobby, or whether he had anything to say to her family. He remained silent. The other surviving killers are in various prisons in New South Wales. And that's all for this case. I hope you enjoyed it. And also, I did forget to say my disclaimer is that I mean absolute no harm to anyone who I talk about in this podcast. This is just information found on the internet and I am reading in my podcast. On that note, I will end it and I will look for another story to read tomorrow. So stay tuned. Bye.